their behavior in the future to affect sex ratios is a big goal of our work. And we get at that that way. Then we wait for the eggs to hatch. Then we determine how many hatched. We determine how many of them are males and females using a testosterone assay, some blood work, because you can't just tell them if they're males or females by looking at them because they look the same as hatchlings. And then we raise these animals for the first year of their life until their shells are stronger, larger, and harder. And we can release them in high quality sites where we have few threats to the tortoises and create a situation that helps to augment, you know, some of these declines that they've been facing.
On that note, Dr. Tom Rodzio, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thanks, John.
This is John Crumshaw with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report. You can always pledge your support at kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. The time now is 1 p.m.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esty Chandler. Today marks 24 years since President George W. Bush called for the establishment of the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. Nearly a year ago, President Trump issued a presidential memorandum directing the expansion of the Migrant Operations Center to hold up to 30,000 immigrants referred to as criminal aliens. The initiative called for existing facilities on the base, separate from the high-security military prison, to be repurposed for temporary immigrant detention, with the first flights of immigrants arriving in early February 2025. Congressional oversight visits began in March and revealed what the military already knew, that the infrastructure was too primitive to house large numbers of people, resulting in inhumane treatment of immigrants being held there. 15 men are still being held in the prison at Guantanamo Bay Detention Facility. 3 have long been approved for release, one by a high-level governmental review process under President Obama in January 2010. 3 others are described as forever prisoners, held explicitly without charge or trial, and with their cases only reviewed via an administrative rather than a legal process by periodic review boards, which were established under President Obama. 9 others are facing or have faced trials in the broken military commission system. 6 have active cases. 1 is serving a life sentence, largely in solitary confinement, after a one-sided trial in 2008, which he refused to mount a defense. Another agreed to a plea deal in 2022, while the last of the 9 is in legal limbo after a Department of Defense sanity board ruled that he was unfit to stand trial in 2023. With us today to discuss the ongoing tragedies at U.S. facilities at Guantanamo, prisoners being held there, expanded uses of the U.S. base there, and the case of Dr. Afia Siddiqui being held at the Federal Medical Center in Fort Worth, Texas, is a favorite guest of the show, Clive Stafford Smith. Clive Stafford Smith is a renowned British-American human rights lawyer, founder of the UK nonprofit Reprieve, best known for his work fighting for justice for people singled out by the state for imprisonment or execution from death row to Guantanamo Bay. With significant involvement in securing releases, fighting torture, he's earned multiple awards for his dedication to civil rights. Having stepped away from his role at Reprieve, Clive is currently working with the Justice League, supporting a generation of new advocates for justice. He has also authored 5 books, including 8 O'Clock Ferry to the Windward Side, Seeking Justice in Guantanamo Bay, and Bad Men, Guantanamo Bay and the Secret Prisons. Clive has gained release for nearly 70 Guantanamo prisoners and continues to represent men detained at the facility. It is always an honor to welcome Clive Stafford Smith back to Middle East in Focus.
You see, Esty, I think that your listeners need to be told I must be paying you enormous amounts of money to go through all that stuff. Anyway, whatever. Let's move on. They must be bored to death by that.
I want to know, due to your humility, I toned it down this year.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
But here we go. Hopefully I didn't get any of that wrong, but you'll correct me if I did. So immigrants have been cycled in and out of the Migrant Operations Center at Guantanamo since early last February. In August, a serious water issue arose. And on September 9th, the government said that only 24 immigrants remained at the site. Led by the ACLU, immigrant rights groups sued, arguing that the practice of mass detention there was unlawful. And last month, a federal judge ruled that the administration exceeded its authority by holding deportees there. Do you have any additional information about whether the administration has heeded the judge's ruling and or information the public should know about the hastily thrown together Trump Hegseth Migrant Operations Center?
Well, the whole thing's a farce, right? I mean, I had actually, the one thing, a very minor thing that you got wrong is I had 87 clients in Guantanamo, and I just got the very last 87th one out in late 2024, when, you know, thinking, well, it's still going to help the people who remained there, but thinking that my job was mostly done in Gitmo. When suddenly Trump promises 30,000 new clients. And I was pretty excited. I thought we'd go down there and argue about that. But actually, it was always a farce. And there was some very good work done by some ACLU immigration lawyers and others. And that battle was won before it even began. And so sort of sadly, from my perspective, I didn't really get to do very much down there. And there are several reasons for this. One is that the essence of the original argument for Guantanamo Bay was that people were not American, they'd never been in America, therefore they didn't enjoy American constitutional rights, which is a pretty stupid argument, but it was actually one that the U.S. Supreme Court had accepted in a Haitian immigration case back in the 90s. But then we sort of reversed that in Rasul versus Bush and the other cases. But then when Trump started sending people there, what his people seemed to have forgotten is they were coming from America. Up till then, they'd either been coming into America from Haiti and never reached America, or they'd been flown there from Afghanistan or wherever. But these new people were coming from America, and therefore their constitutional rights were right on the plane next to them. And so the whole pretext for using Guantanamo fell apart. And it seems to me that there's a bigger lesson here. And it involves Maduro and Venezuela, that the whole argument with Guantanamo that we encountered back in 2002 was that somehow we could have a prison with no rights, no anything. And that was because it was a war and these were illegal enemy combatants. And what Trump tried to do was invert that. And this is the great danger for Americans of this whole Venezuela fiasco, is that it's hard to know which is chicken and which is egg. Did Trump decide he wanted to invade Venezuela and then go through all the shenanigans? Or did he actually paint himself into a corner? Because he kept saying that this was a war and that fentanyl was a weapon of mass destruction. The Venezuelans were attacking America, and that's why he could blow up all those people in boats, many of whom appear not to have been drug dealers at all. And then he sort of invades Venezuela and takes Maduro. This is incredibly dangerous, and it's what was originally dangerous to my mind about Guantanamo, was the idea that we could put someone on a base, you know, it wasn't quite America, and say, because you're an illegal enemy combatant, you don't have any legal rights at all, and we can torture you and do other horrible things and keep you there for what is now 20 plus years without a trial. And, you know, this is just so un-American, but it's a reason why we need to continually be aware of Guantanamo. And in the end, we need to do to Guantanamo what I want to do, which is turn it into a museum. and a museum that people can go visit, and they'll learn the catastrophic folly of the whole experiment.
I agree with you, and it reminds me of the museum at Robben Island that I toured.
Well, I was just writing something today. I've been to Afghanistan 5 times on Afia Siddiqui's case recently. And one of the things I've talked to the Afghans about is turning the 22 black sites in Afghanistan into museums to go along with this most amazing thing that your listeners should really go visit sometime, which is the Soviet tank graveyard. Have you ever heard of that? It's amazing. There's one just near Herat in Afghanistan. Just hundreds of Soviet tanks that got left behind after the Soviet invasion. And these things are just astounding. And when you think about Vietnam, you know, the Vietnamese have done what I think is an interesting job of turning some of those underground tunnels that the Viet Cong would use and turning those into tourist places. And I think that's really important on two levels. One is it's good for them to, you know, make a little tourist money, I suppose. But the more important issue is that we will always repeat the errors of history if we don't know what that history is. And so those museums are just really important. You know, look at Afghanistan, 21 years, the longest war in American history. And what did it achieve? Absolutely nothing except a terrible stain on our reputation.
So 3 of the Guantanamo prisoners have long been cleared for resettlement. Do you represent any of them? And can you briefly tell us about the factors holding up their releases?
I don't represent them directly, so it's not mine to opine too much. But basically, there are several factors. You know, one of them, for example, is deathly afraid of going on a plane and being treated in the same way that he was when he was taken. So even though he's cleared to leave, because the way he was abused on the plane going over there, where they put him in these stress positions and put a hood on his head and did terrible things, and he thought he was going to be thrown out of the plane at any moment. You know, he's just really psychologically traumatized by that. And it's something that, you know, people there seem immune to understanding, which is that the prisoners, and you mentioned one person, Samson Ben Al-Shib, you didn't mention his name, who's been found in Conflict Central. These folk who went through the most unspeakable torture, and the most extreme perhaps being what happened to my client, Benyam Mohammed, where they took a razor blade to his genitals every 2 weeks for a year and a half in Morocco. They're then taken to Guantanamo, where they're abused some more, and they can't get treatment because, you know, they have a group called the Biscuit Team, which is the psychology, social sciences team, who are meant to, you know, be mental health people. But actually what they were doing was helping the interrogators understand how to break each of these individual prisoners. So, you know, you don't have to be a great expert to understand that those type people can't give therapy to victims of torture. And it's something we've struggled with in Guantanamo over many years, which is, you know, you got to let people go to some place that they can get our treatment. And thankfully, that's happened for 98% of the prisoners now, but not 15 who remain.
You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Esty Chandler, enormously grateful to be joined today, which marks the 22nd year since the establishment of Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, by Clive Stafford Smith, who has represented scores of men held at Guantanamo.
As much safe.
Yes, I'm trying to be safe. So, Clive, 9 of the 15 prisoners who remain at Guantanamo are facing or have faced trials in the ridiculously flawed military commission system that you have described. 6 have active cases. Do you represent any of those? And what should the public know about those men and their cases?
I've only helped on those cases because I'm a dual national, as you say, half British. They won't give me a top secret security clearance, so I can't actually meet with what people who are called high value detainees. But I have tried to help in whatever way I can. And, you know, it is shocking. Here we are, 20 some years on, and none of these guys have had a meaningful trial of any sort. And they're never going to get one because you can't torture people for years and then think you can give them a fair trial. And, you know, the Biden administration had tried to resolve all of this and come up with a plea agreement that was accepted by many, many of the 9/11 victims' families because, you know, they have suffered for 25 years now, too. And part of the deal was that these guys would plead to a life sentence, they'd die in Guantanamo, but they would then answer any questions that the victims had to try to help people reach some sense of closure, if that's a possibility in something as monstrous as 9/11. But of course, now, you know, that's been overridden and Trump doesn't want to go along with that. And, you know, that then gets litigated for the next forever because there was an agreement. And the question is, can you just jerk that agreement away since everyone had settled on it? And it's just a simple contract issue, really. So every time they turn around in Guantanamo, they do something else that's just a big violation of the law. And as a result, they create issues that will get litigated for the next 10 years. And it's just a waste of everyone's time and money. I mean, they're up to $15 million a year per prisoner at this point. I had one of my clients write an essay about how he'd spend his $15 million. You know, he gold plate his cell. He doubled the salaries of all the soldiers there just because they had such a miserable life too. He did make a donation to my charity, he said, of $1 million. I'd love to see that. And he still would have had about $12 million left over. I mean, it's such a waste of our tax money. It really is.
It is. And to your point, are they making any arrangements? The prisoners are aging and they're soon going to need nursing home, possibly hospice care for elderly inmates. Are they making any of those kinds of arrangements?
Esther, you're making me feel bad now because I was just talking to my wife about how when I got Sefula Paracha out, I became the oldest at Guantanamo. Sefula, thank goodness, was 73 and older than me. And that was great because it allowed me to not feel quite so decrepit. But I'm now older than all the Guantanamo prisoners, but they're getting up there. I'm 66, and they're getting right up there themselves. And of course, because life expectancy in an American prison is about 65, whereas outside we're lucky to have another 20 years, you know, we are going to be seeing just a bunch of geriatrics there. And, you know, what is served by prolonging this whole process, it's very hard to see. And, you know, it will result in all sorts of other litigation. We had a lot with Sefula because Saif had had a couple of heart attacks before he went to Guantanamo, had another one while he was there, couldn't get the health care that he needed. And you know, I was just really grateful to get him out so that he could get treatment in Pakistan. And he's now, thankfully, still alive and pretty well. But that's just not going to be possible, and it's going to be more expensive on the taxpayer to get them their health care in Guantanamo.
So I want to ask you about another client of yours, Dr. Afia Siddiqui, the Pakistani neuroscientist convicted in New York in 2010 for allegedly trying to shoot at U.S. personnel in Afghanistan in 2008. Currently serving an 86-year sentence in a federal prison in Fort Worth, Texas. Siddiqui came to the U.S. in 1990 and got an undergraduate degree in biology at MIT, followed by a PhD from Brandeis University in cognitive neuroscience. In the wake of American hostility towards Muslims following 9/11, she decided to return to Pakistan in 2003 with her three children, after she separated from her husband. What should we know about her arrest that happened following that in Pakistan?
Oh, God, Steve, how many hours do you have?
We have about 9 minutes.
Oh, dear. Well, I filed with the U.S. attorneys in New York 350-page pleading proving her innocence. And actually, it's not true that she left America after she got divorced to her husband. She left America because her abusive husband had three visits from the FBI for things he was up to. And if there's a bad guy in all of this, initially it's him. The most extraordinary thing about Amjad Khan, the father of her three children, is that when she was abducted by the CIA on the 30th of March, 2003, along with her three children, Amjad didn't do anything to get his kids back. He just married another woman. And since he'd lost a daughter, age four, called Mariam, he just had another girl and called her Mariam. I mean, you know, to me, that's just one of those little facts that's so disgusting, it's hard to believe. But I've now unpicked it all. It's been really interesting. And I can prove why they made a big mistake about her. I mean, the first thing was they said she was a senior leader of Al-Qaeda, whereas you and I could tell them right off the bat there weren't any women. That's why she's the only woman who was put through the torture program. And all of that came from lies that were told about her, largely by her soon-to-be ex-husband. But the shocking thing, and I really thought no one could shock me anymore, was that first she was a woman. I don't know if torturing a woman is that much different from torturing a man. But the thing that's totally different about her is they took her three children with her. So Ahmed, age six, U.S. citizen, the CIA took him 1,000 kilometers up to Kabul from Pakistan and put him in prison and changed his name to Ihsan Ali and left him there. And he was there for 5 years. They took the daughter, Mariam, age four, U.S. citizen, took her to Afghanistan, forcibly adopted her into a white Christian CIA family under the obvious principle that the only way to heaven is to be a white Christian American. And she was there for 7 years until she was rescued. And I talked to former President Hamid Karzai about this, and because he was the one who helped get her back. And the fact that everyone's lied about this for all these years, Hamid Karzai is a witness to say, you know, they have been lying. Then the third child, Suleiman, age 6 months, the only evidence we have is that maybe he was dropped on his head and killed, but no one's ever confirmed that. And actually, one thing I plan to do in America is run a thing called Searching for Suleiman, where we've done AI pictures of what he would look like over the years. Because I think there's a 50-50 chance that he was adopted into an American family and is now 23 years old and doesn't know who his biological mother is. I've been to Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan several times, and I've seen where Afia was tortured. I've got a whole bunch of witnesses about it. So all of that we can now prove. And instead of attempting to murder two U.S. servicemen, I've been to Ghazni, where all of this happened, and all of that's nonsense. She was herself shot. She was the only person who was shot in the incident. And she is, and we have really a lot of evidence that she's totally innocent. But in the meantime, she's been in FMC Karzai now for 17 years. And she's really a broken human being because she suffered. You know, imagine everyone out there who's got children. Imagine that your children are abducted and they're abused. And then the U.S., the CIA pretended to torture children in front of her and said they were her children. You know, imagine what that would do to you and then multiply it by 20-some years. This poor woman. And so I'm trying to persuade the U.S. attorneys, who are really plenty busy enough with prosecuting Maduro in New York, that they should just agree to be compassionate and let me take her to another country, not Pakistan, because the Pakistanis are some of the bad guys in this, so that we can get her the treatment she needs and try to put her back together. And so she can see the children that we do have, her two children, who are now in their late 20s. And, you know, hopefully put her life back a little bit together.
Can you talk a little bit about how Afia is regarded by the public in Pakistan and the role that the Pakistani government and government corruption play and have played in her case? Because that's what ties it to Guantanamo, I think.
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, look, a lot of people who ended up in Guantanamo were sold to the CIA for bounties. A lot of money changed hands. We know this is true because President Musharraf boasted about it in his terrible book, In the Line of Fire, page 234. And they did that to Afia too. And the problem is this, Afia is now, and has been for a long time, the most famous woman in Pakistan. A sister who is a true saint, and if you're in trouble ever, you want to have Fawzia Siddiqui as your sister, because she's a Harvard-educated neurologist and has fought for years for her sister and bullied me into taking the case on for nothing 3 years ago.
Woman.
Oh, she's fabulous. And so we've fought to get help from the Pakistan government, and they've not only not helped, they've actively tried to prevent us. I've had two of my witnesses threatened with death in recent times. One of my witnesses, he actually came to Britain and shot at him on New Year's Eve in Cambridge. And on Christmas Eve, they sent someone around to beat him up. Because I've got an ISI agent also who is a former secret agent for Pakistan who's told the truth. And they don't like that. And so Pakistan has resisted because they've been part of the problem here. And that's awful. And it's awful that poor Fawzia is in Karachi. They've dropped their bodies outside her house. They've sent her bullets, saying what they're going to do to her. They've abducted her two or three times. And this woman has stood up to him in a way that is magnificent. But I do worry about it because, you know, I'm an old privileged white male in Britain and I'm pretty safe. So I don't care what I say about those people, but she is really putting her neck on the line for her sister, which is really fabulous.
And how's the best way for people to follow her case and perhaps engage in some sort of advocacy for her?
Well, there is something that Fawzia started called the Afia Movement, and you can go to afiamovement.com and see what's going on by and large. And then you can help us. Look, I mean, one of the things is Afia hasn't been allowed to have an imam in the prison for the last 20 years, so we need spiritual support from all sorts of people, not just Muslims, saying that's wrong. She hadn't been able to have medical treatment for all sorts of reasons, so we need medical doctors to say that's just outrageous. And then we need people in general to offer up their expertise. It's been really fun proving what I think the legal term is total bullshit, the government's cases. But, you know, I need people to help me as experts on engineering, things like that. So you can give out my email and I will be glad to have volunteers of all stripes. And we need publicity. We need the story to be told properly because the CIA has sort of locked her Wikipedia page. And everything on that page is nonsense and we can't change it. So we just have to compete with this and get the truth up there in different ways.
Well, we'll do what we can. As always, I can't thank you enough, Clive, for taking the time to share your knowledge with us, to inform us, and most of all, for the great work you do for justice and human rights.
Oh, look, I have to do it or my mother will strike me dead. So, you know, I don't have a choice, do I?
God bless your mother. At a cost of $500 million per year historically, Guantanamo is the most expensive detention camp on earth. It has been the iconic example of the post-9/11 abandonment of the rule of law and continues to fuel and justify bigotry, stereotyping, and stigma. Clive Stafford Smith has said, quote, "My whole theory is Guantanamo is all a lie. They've got it all secret because they want to pretend they're doing something about 9/11. And if we open it up to public inspection, they will close it down because it will be too embarrassing." He continued, "I've represented 87 people at Guantanamo. The courts ordered the release of one. The other 86 got out because we went in there. We got the truth out. We published it. And we embarrassed the U.S. military so much that they said, let's send this guy home." End quote. Guantanamo Bay remains an indelible stain on U.S. history. Once again, I want to thank our guest, Clive Stafford Smith, renowned British-American human rights lawyer and founder of the Justice League, which fosters and supports a generation of new